This week on Grape Encounters Radio.
How about ice cubes in wine?
Oh, God.
Well,
I can't believe that a wine drinker of your stature would even use the words ice cube and wine in the same sentence.
And now, transmitting our signal to wine lovers of the world from our Atascadero Wine Cellar Studio in the heart of the Central Coast wine country of San Luis Obispo County, California, we bring you Grape Encounters with David Wilson.
Peel me a grape. Crush me some ice. Skin me a peach. Save the fuzz for my pillow.
You know, it wasn't all that long ago that getting information about wine was something of a challenge. You had basically three choices. You could go visit your local wine purveyor and hope that they could help you. You could go out to the wineries and get some firsthand information, or perhaps subscribe to a couple of the credible wine publications. But oh, how times have changed with the internet. And now the number of wine bloggers out there is absolutely staggering. There's really an overabundance of information about wine available to you, some of it incredibly good, some of it perhaps just a little bit questionable. Well, there's one person that I've known for a very long time. His name is Jim Newcomb. He's the author of the Sommelier Update, and I think he's probably one of the single most knowledgeable guys that you'll ever talk to when it comes to wine. Now, if you don't talk to him, you can read everything that he has to say at the Sommelier Update, which is now the number two wine blog in the country. So I thought it might be nice to have Jim on today, and maybe we could give him a hand to push him up to that number one position. Hey, Jim, welcome to Grape Encounters. It's been a while.
Thanks, Dave. Good to be with you.
Great to be with you. You're kind of the Avis of wine blogs right now.
Yeah, right now, you're right. I am number two.
Okay, so you're sitting in the number two position, but where were you when you started?
Well, I think when the first vote came in, when I got my number one vote for my wine blog, I was about 976 on the list.
Okay, so how long did it take you to get from 976 to the number two position?
Well, I started the blog probably about 4 years ago, and the voting probably started about 3 years ago. And it's amazing, when I first started out, I saw a lot of these wine blogs just kind of pass me up and keep on moving, but slow and steady, as you said. It's been moving up and continues to move up as more and more people are reading the blog. They're voting for it. I've got a voting button on my blog, and people are voting for it. So it's a good sign. I guess people like what they're reading.
So who actually decides whether you're number one, number two, or number 1001? I mean, how does that process actually work? Who is the all-knowing and all-powerful Oz?
It's actually on thelocalwineevents.com. They are tracking wine blogs. It's more of a popularity contest, but it's an international popularity contest. So I'm competing, I think, I believe the number one guy right now is actually out of Germany. But it's just wine readers that are voting on this particular site, and they tabulate the votes, and they just keep on going from there.
So your wine blog goes beyond the typical wine blog. A lot of the wine blogs are writing about their local wine scene. Your wine blog gets into wines literally all over the world, and of course you're a foodie as well, so you get pretty deep into the food and wine scene, and you'll even find all kinds of pairing suggestions and recipes on the wine blog. Does that information stay there forever?
Yes, all my blogs are there. They go back for the last 4 years, and you are correct. My blog is a little bit different approach than what some of the other wine bloggers are doing. Most of them are writing about their wine tastings and giving their opinion. And as you know, as a sommelier, I always have felt that taste is personal. And for me to give my opinion doesn't mean that someone else is going to like what I like. So I took a different approach with my wine blog, and that is I write from an educational standpoint. For example, if I'm writing about food, I will give examples of what wines to pair with it, not the particular winery, but what grapes and styles of grapes might work best for that type of food. So it's a different approach than I think anyone else is taking right now.
Well, I think this is an issue that we deal with all the time on Grape Encounters Radio, because it really doesn't behoove us to talk about a specific brand of wine, because we have listeners literally all over the world, and a lot of them just don't have access to some of the wines that we might choose to talk about. So it makes a lot more sense to talk about the varietals. And if the wine is true to its varietal character, well, I think that can be very helpful and you have no problem.
Well, that's true. But, and you know, if you believe in the theory of terroir, then you're going to also find that different regions, for example, a Cabernet Sauvignon is going to taste different possibly in California than it does in France. So And you need to understand that, what the differences are.
Of course.
And I do talk about that in my wine blogs. And again, mine is more of an educational type site, and we have fun with it.
Well, don't misunderstand me. I'm in total agreement on what you're saying. And a good example might be something like Sauvignon Blanc. If you took a Sauvignon Blanc from California and you tasted it side by side with a Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand, you'd find that those two wines were decidedly different, very different characteristics, and I can tell the two apart almost instantly. So it is very important to know the difference between how one region affects the way a wine will turn out versus how another one will. And I think that's relatively simple to explain, isn't it?
Yes, we do do that when I write those. And if you're not familiar with the region, I try and give you ideas to kind of understand that. If you know that a wine is coming from a cooler region versus a warmer region, then you'll anticipate certain characteristics in that. And we do discuss that, and that helps you with your wine pairing. And it's not just wine pairings that we do. I talk about the different individual grapes. I've talked about histories of different areas. But everything's in a brief format. I try not to make it into a full textbook. I want it to simple that you can read it fairly quickly. I update it once a week with whatever subjects are recommended by readers of the blog. I get all kinds of inspiration on what to write. And I never really know from week to week what I'm going to write. It's based on emails that I'm getting. For example, this week's article is about charcuterie. I had someone on Facebook, a friend of mine on Facebook, sent an email saying, Jim Newcomb, where are you? I'm having charcuterie and I don't know what wine flight to pair with it. So I thought, well, let's write about charcuterie and what wines go best with that.
You have to first do a column on how to pronounce it.
That's true.
There's as many pronunciations for charcuterie or charcuterie, as I say it, as there are for sommelier. Sommelier.
Yes, well, that's one of the challenges, I think, with my wine blog is a lot of people don't know how to spell sommelier. They're a bit challenged trying to find it. But I think more and more people are learning it. I probably could have simplified it and just called it the Somm update. Now with that movie out there, I think everyone is more comfortable just saying Somm rather than sommelier.
Yeah, they actually did us a big favor with that.
Yeah, they simplified it for everybody else. Correct.
Jim, why don't you just call it the Really Smart Wine Guy blog?
I don't want to make wine condescending to people. I really try and keep it open and simple and fun.
All right, then call it the Really Helpful Wine Guy Update.com. We're talking to Jim Newcomb. He is the author of the Sommelier Update. The Sommelier Update is the Cliff Notes of wine blogs, the number two wine blog in America. Just this far away from number one. Gosh, so close, but yet so far. So what are we talking anyway? Number two in the known universe?
Well, right now, yeah, it's an international popularity contest is basically what it is. And for any of your listeners, if they want to go to the site, I would certainly appreciate them voting for it. On the upper right-hand corner, there is a click here button to vote for my blog. And that's where these votes are coming from, is people reading the blog.
Okay, so tell them how they can get to the blog, because a lot of people are probably sitting at their computers right now, and they can do two things at one time, listen to the show and vote for your blog. Though in all fairness, they probably should read the blog first and decide whether they like it.
Well, certainly. I mean, I hope that people are reading the blog. That's the whole idea. I don't want people just to vote, but if they enjoy the blog, I would appreciate it if they would vote. But the wine blog is thesommelierupdate.com, and again, sommelier is Sommelier. So all together, it's thesommelierupdate.com.
So if somebody spells sommelier wrong, will Google help them get it right? You know how they do that? It's where they come up with that message. Did you mean sommelier?
I would think so. I would guess a lot of people are misspelling sommelier.
We're talking to my good friend Jim Newcomb. He's the author of the Sommelier Update and an all-around nice guy. He will never be pretentious. He will never mislead you. He will always give you good advice. And you'll find all kinds of things that go beyond wine on the Sommelier Update, including a lot of really good information on food, even recipes. And Jim, you got some yummy pictures on the site as well.
Well, thank you.
You know, on a personal note, I want to give a shout out to our friends, Jim and Brenda Gibson. It was about 3 weeks ago that we all got together, your wife, mine, and Jim and Brenda, and had an amazing meal at their house. Brenda is an incredible cook who has this fabulous pizza oven, and she makes these gourmet pizzas, gluten-free, of course. She brought out a feast that was simply unbelievable, and it kept coming and coming and coming. and each course was better than the last. She just needs to give up what she's doing and focus 100% of her attention on what she does in the kitchen, because it is purely remarkable. So just a little shout out to Jim and Brenda, especially you, Brenda.
I will tell you, I would work with her anytime if she wants to do food and wine pairings. That was a thoroughly enjoyable evening.
Actually, Brenda is one of the most acclaimed American artists working today. And, you know, there's something to be said for people who are artistic on canvas. They often are artistic in the kitchen as well. I kind of like painting with food, if you will.
Well, you eat with your eyes.
Anyway, you're listening to Grape Encounters Radio. My guest is Jim Newcomb. He is the number two blogger in the known world, the Sommelier Update. Coming up also on the show in just a little bit, it's going to be Wilfred Wong talking about ice in wine, and the wine editor of Sunset Magazine, Sarah Schneider, talking about tasting room etiquette. But we'll continue with our conversation with an all-around really nice guy, Jim Newcomb, in just a moment on Grape Encounters Radio. So don't go anywhere.
Hi, this is Rob Reiner, and you're listening to Grape Encounters. I don't know what the hell that means, but you're listening to it.
And your Grape Encounter continues with David Wilson. And you know what I really find a lot of joy in? I love going into a place that sells wine retail and stumbling upon somebody who is wandering aimlessly up and down the aisle, perplexed about the choices in front of them. And I usually will stop and ask them if they need a little help. At first, they think that I work for the place. And when they realize I don't, I guess they question my motives. But nonetheless, they very quickly warm up to me, because a lot of people really appreciate that help. Well, today, my guest is Jim Newcomb. He is the brainchild behind the Sommelier Review, which is the number two wine blog in all the world. And Jim, do you ever ask people if they need help when you're in that situation?
All the time. I observe people purchasing their wines and looking at their struggles, and that's where I get my ideas from. And yes, I do talk to people and try and find out what they're looking for and get an understanding of what types of wines they like, or what they're making for dinner and what they're trying to pair it with.
How do you know whether the information that you're getting from a wine blog is reliable? There are so many wine blogs out there, and lots of qualified people writing them, and then others, you know, perhaps not as qualified. How do you tell the difference?
That's a good question. I really can't answer that. And you're right. Anyone can write a wine blog. They don't have to be a sommelier. It could be just a wine enthusiast that wants to write a wine blog. You know, everyone and the brother will give you their opinion on what they like. So again, I mentioned before that I don't give my wine tasting opinion as far as what my favorite winery is. I mean, I'll make some recommendations here and there, but I won't go into the full description of the wines, because then, I believe wine is personal. And if you like a certain inexpensive wine that you can buy for about $2, and you like that better than something, say, from Bordeaux that's a couple $100s, then who am I to judge what you like? What you like is what you like. So I don't write about wine in particular as far as tasting notes or anything like that, because, again, I feel it's very personal. And that's what I think most of the wine blogs out there are right now, is a lot of people writing their own personal tasting notes.
You know, we will have on the show in just a little bit Wilfred Wong, who is now the chief storyteller for wine.com, formerly the cellar master for BevMo. And I got to tell you, I have a lot of respect for wine.com. I've spent a considerable amount of time in their offices, and they really do their homework, and they're very careful about the wines that they choose. There are a lot of places that do that. They taste the wines by committee. They're very careful about the choices that they offer to consumers. You have to remember that a lot of retailers really do the homework for you. If you go into a credible wine shop, the chances are that the wines that they're stocking are going to be wines that they've carefully reviewed and have judged to be appropriate for sale.
Oh, I agree with you 100% on that one. And Wilfred Wong has got a great reputation. And I think people need to understand, if you like his tasting notes and you find that you like his types of wines, and the same thing would be with Robert Parker. If you like those style of wines that Robert Parker likes, then of course you're going to, those are the guys that you're going to attach onto and read their tasting notes. And again, on my wine blog, my approach has not been to do the tasting notes, but more of the educational, so you can make your own decisions based on what your likes and dislikes are. And again, to educate you about different grapes and what to expect, what the different styles might be, and food pairings, and different fun little things. For example, we had one a couple weeks ago. Someone was asking about the Wine Century Club, and I don't know if you're familiar with that one or your listeners are, but it's for people that want to try different grape varieties. And once you reach 100 different grape varieties that you try, then you can become a member of the century, the Wine Century Club, and just some fun things like that that people might not be aware of.
How do they keep track of that? How do they know that you're being honest about what you drank?
The Wine Century Club is on an honor system to begin with for the first 100 grapes that you try, and they have a tracking system. You can download it off their site, and again, I've got all the information on my wine blog. It was written probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago, so you can go back in the history and find it there. But you can download their tracking sheet, and you just track the wines that you have tried. You have to do a little research. If it's a blend, you can count all the different grapes. Research if it's a blend, you can count all the different grapes that are in there. Fun building from there and get into the 200 wine club, the 300 wine club, and on up. So it's a fun little thing if you really want to try all these different wines.
I'll tell you what, it sounds like a lot of fun, but it's also a lot of work. I do a lot of wine consulting, and right now I'm tasting through a couple of cases of wine. It seems like a lot of fun, but the truth of the matter is it does take a lot of time to go through those wines and not let your palate get all beat up.
That's what sommeliers do. We taste wines and try to determine what will be the best thing for pairing with a certain food item. And you're right. It's a lot of people think, oh, what a great job. We can go out drinking. Well, drinking and tasting are two different things.
Yeah, and also when you're tasting through that many wines, you've got all these bottles open and you've only consumed maybe just a quarter of a glass, and suddenly you're staring down 24 bottles of wine that you hope you can preserve, but probably will not be able to in many cases. Okay, Jim, the most unusual question that anybody has ever asked you on the Sommelier Update blog.
Well, the latest one that was kind of unusual, and I hadn't spent a whole lot of time on it, was someone asking me about verjus, the green grapes. When you're dropping it during green harvest, what do you do with all that? And actually, I had to do some research on it, and it was very interesting research for anyone that has not used verjus. It's very popular in European countries, and I think it's just starting to catch on around here, and that's the one that comes to mind because it's one of the more recent ones, but I do get some very unusual requests. But the verjus question was one that I actually had to research a little bit and really try and figure out how to make that work, and it's a very interesting article.
Okay, so check out the article on verjus and the numerous other articles and tidbits of important information that you'll find on the Sommelier Update. It's the number two wine blog in the world. You deserve to be number one. You work really, really hard. So vote for the Sommelier Update when you're on the blog.
I work hard. I write that every week. I spend probably a few hours every week researching and writing my articles based on requests from your listeners, as well as emails to me and through Facebook. And I also have a Facebook site, which is the Sommelier Update also. You can search it on Facebook, and that one is just more fun on articles and cartoons and that type of thing. But you'll also get my wine blog on that site.
Okay, I wish we had more time to talk to Jim Newcomb, the author of the Sommelier Update. He's somebody that you can really trust and a wonderful source of information, so check it out online. However, we do have coming up next the wine editor of Sunset Magazine, Sarah Schneider, and then followed by Wilfred Wong of Wine.com, a show full of really big experts on grape encounters. Stay with us. All right, with wine being the number one adult beverage in America, that happened about 3 or 4 years ago. Sarah Schneider, wine editor of Sunset Magazine, and I decided we're going to take you tasting all over the world in just a few minutes. Are you packed?
I'm packed.
Packed and ready to go.
Put that seatbelt on.
All right, Sarah actually brought up this topic to me, and I love this topic, which is, you know, how have things changed in tasting rooms around the country, and who's pretentious, who's not, and more than that, what should your tasting room behavior be? Because you know, Sarah, there are tasting rooms. You can go and people are swinging from the chandelier. We know people like that. It used to be that tasting rooms went through a phase where they were just like, sit down and try some wine, and it was free. And then Napa wines especially got so well known that the tasting fees started to show up. By the way, and I love it when tasting room people tell you, well, we're required to charge a fee. That's not true,
no,
is it?
I don't think that's true.
I don't think that's true. Maybe it depends on the license that they
have. It might be from region to region.
You know, they're quick to give away tastings. If you buy the wine, they're going to refund your tasting fee in most cases. And if they don't, stop payment on a credit card. Now, I'm tough.
You're going straight there.
It's like
you're giving all the rights to the taster.
The reason this whole tasting thing is, in my opinion, a complete and total mess. There are two types of tasters. There is the taster who is going there and they genuinely want to taste the wine because they're on a mission to buy some wine and bring it home, right?
Fair enough. They can come, taste through, see what they like, and they're willing deal is there to buy some wine.
Second kind of taster is there to drink wine. In fact, that you can tell that person when they have the little regulator on the bottle and they pour out the wine, the 1 ounce or half ounce or whatever it is pour, there's a little dribble in the bottom of the glass and they look at it with disdain.
It's very frustrating when all you're going to get.
And they go, can I have a little more? After the first taste, whether or not you really mean it, say, oh, I'm definitely going to buy 5 or 6 of those Cabernets. Then the next pour, when they shortchange you, you just go ahead and say, can I, you know, I'm not sure, can I just try a little more of that? Because you've already planted the seed that you're a buyer.
You have all the tricks.
Yeah, don't really do that. That's not fair. If you're a drinker, not a taster, there are so many great wine bars out there. You can go into the wine bar and you can say, hey, you know what? This is what I like. And they'll come bring you a taste of this, that, and the other thing. They won't charge you a dime for that. And then they'll zero in on what you want and they'll pour you a nice glass of wine and maybe you can even buy a bottle of it. And get away from the tasting bar because we want to taste wine and we don't really want you there.
It's a good point.
Am I being too tough? I'm being too tough.
No. I'm on both sides. I'm for the taster and I'm for the winery tasting room.
I love how you walk the fence.
I'm shameless. I remember a conversation up in Amador County, California, which is up and coming. It was 5 years ago, even, just a very sleepy tasting place. Only a few people were charging for tasting and you could meander around Shenandoah Valley Drive. And then sleeker tasting rooms came in. The wine bar was raised and suddenly Sacramento, which is within an hour's drive, discovered it. And then limos started coming up with bridesmaids parties and bachelorette parties.
That's the worst.
And I remember a conversation with one of the winemakers there, and he said, you know, we had to actually raise our fees just to control the kind of crowd that came into the tasting room, because it's a great service to be able to taste wine directly from that winery and then buy it. The winery can sell it directly to you, save the middlemen cost, and that's a great business model. The recreational tasting around the edges, which I'll grant is fun up to a point, it can really mess it up for the people who are really in search of wine.
I used to think that the tasting rooms liked it when the bridal party came in. They hate that.
They hate that.
But I'm going to tell you fellas something, just a little tip, okay? A little tip from Uncle Dave, all right? If you're single and you're looking to meet somebody, you know, don't worry about the online dating services. Here's what I want you to do. Get yourself dressed up really sharp, wait till May, and then spend every weekend wine tasting in May. Because that's when the bridal parties are out for the June wedding. And they're out en masse, and the girls are all dressed up really, really nice. Needless to say, they're in a festive mood. And you can actually...
You're bad.
No. You can actually wear an S on your forehead to symbolize that you're single, and this will be good for you. But anyway, May, bridal parties, meet single people. That's it.
Where would you send them? Napa, Sonoma, Oregon, Washington, Idaho?
Well, Central Coast is good because it's really unpretentious there, and there's a lot of wineries there. Napa, you're going to have more competition, fellows, because I've got a lot of listeners up there, and they're already writing this down. You know what, Sarah? It doesn't matter. Go any place. May, wine tasting, bridal parties. That's it. And you can actually call the limo companies and say, how many parties do you have booked this weekend? That's a good barometer.
This is getting deeper.
Did we get off topic?
I think maybe a little bit.
So back to the tasting room. The whole point is that tasting rooms are exactly that.
But I think that they got off track somewhere along the way. You know, when we first started into this in the maybe 70s, 80s, there was a real excitement about the tasting room and not as many crowds. And then through, I would say maybe through the 90s, in a place like Napa, there was a pretension that grew. The tasting rooms got grander and grander. And it was like Highway 29 and Silverado Trail are just lined with tasting mansions in a way. And there was a little bit of, oh, well, you're lucky to come to us sort of attitude.
A little bit.
I'm being gentle.
A lot. But don't torque the people in Napa because...
No. I think that we're getting beyond that now. I think that they're realizing that there has to be a reason to go to them. And sure, they don't want everybody. They don't want necessarily the party crowds in there. They want people who are serious about their wines. But now it seems like we won't go to a tasting room unless there are many, many add-ons, a bocce court at the very least, food and wine pairings, which are now allowed in Napa. legally. Blending seminars to be had, outdoor picnicking, gardens, you know, whatever the add-ons are.
Here's what I think their strategy became. I may have this completely wrong, but it's my observation that they are doing everything in their power to keep you on the property, because if doggone it, if you're not going home with a case of the wine, you're going to buy two bottles while you're there and drink it there out in the park among the swans.
That's very
and
true.
And the bungee jumpers.
And you know, I think that's actually a really good idea.
Good idea too.
I have people ask me, okay, I'm going to be in Sonoma Saturday afternoon. What six wineries should I hit? And I'm thinking that would be the stupidest afternoon you could have. The sixth winery is going to have it's going to be a blur.
Still number five.
Yeah, exactly. One great trend I'm seeing is that wineries, and let me just name Oregon as a place where this is happening in spades. A lot of the new wineries are offering different kinds of tasting experiences for normal folks in different spaces, not necessarily the secret salon. You can have a guided tasting, you can have a general tasting, you can do food and wine in different spaces in their winery, open to just folks. And I love that trend.
I think that that's great. And I think the bottom line is this, is that if you don't completely understand and accept the fact that they're giving you something in most cases, and even if they're charging you for it, most tasting rooms will charge you a reasonable fee. Some, it's ridiculous. And I suggest turn around and leave, because truth is, there's a tasting room down the road that's not as expensive. It's going to treat you like a human being and you'll enjoy it. But the most important lesson in all of this is, whether you pay a fee or not, you do not have to buy the wine. And so many people, I think, feel guilty when they're in a tasting room because they feel like they have to buy the wine. They're going to insult somebody. Don't you think so?
You know, I actually am more comfortable paying a fee, because then I absolutely feel obligated to buy the wine. If it's free, I almost feel obligated to buy the wine.
I think there should just be a tip jar there.
That's a good point. That'd be a great idea.
Yeah, let's do an honor system thing here. And if by 2 o'clock that jar is not mostly full, the fee kicks in. And then a sign lights up in neon that says, you asked for it, you got it. And that's it. Okay. Did we clear this up for folks?
Done.
Okay. The less known a wine region is, the cheaper the tasting fee is going to be, or it will be non-existent. And I really don't think that when somebody says that they're required to charge you, that that's really the case. What they're really saying is, I don't really think you're a buyer. We're just selling you several tastes of wine. Fair enough though, right?
Sure.
Sarah, we are both on the same side on this one.
Oh.
That's going to do it for Sipping with Sarah. Always a pleasure to have on the Brain Trust, Wine Brain Trust, that is Sarah Schneider. If you want to know anything about wine, she is definitely your go-to woman. But before we get off the subject of wine tasting rooms, I kind of want to take a little side trip to the subject of tasting wine in restaurants, or buying wine by the glass in restaurants, because there are a number of things that really, really get under my skin, and it's been happening more and more these days. And that is that I go into a restaurant, order what I think is a good glass of wine, and it turns out that the wine is turned. And I'm going to tell you that pretty frequently, I send that wine back. I'm going to say maybe these days, 1 out of 5. And there are some reasons why that happens. And so you can hedge your bet if you ask the right questions, or at least observe what's going on in the restaurant or in the wine bar. The first thing to consider is, how many wines are they actually pouring by the glass? Now, if they're pouring a lot of wines by the glass, that means that the likelihood of the wine being used up fast is probably not so good. You can ask the person who is serving you what the most popular wines by the glass are, and those are the ones that are probably going to be less likely to be turned, because the turnover on those bottles is going to be pretty quick. But one of the problems is those wines are also the cheapest wines, and maybe not the best wines, and that's because people tend to go for the less pricier wines in most places. So it's really a double-edged sword where that is concerned. The second thing is that if you walk into a wine bar or a restaurant and you see that the wines are in what looks like a kind of a cabinet that has hoses going into the bottles, and they're pouring the wine through a spout, that's a pretty good sign that the wine is going to be in pretty good shape when you drink it, because those devices, and there are a number of different kinds of those around these days, they actually keep air from getting into the bottle, and they inject an inert gas into the wine bottle to make sure that the wine is protected from the air, because any exposure to air is going to cause that that wine to turn, especially the red wines. Of course, if the wine bottle is only, let's say, a third full, then the chances are even greater that it's going to turn very, very quickly, maybe within a day. So looking in the restaurant, checking it out to see if they have that kind of preservation system is a really good idea. You'll also see in wine bars people using something along the lines of a vacuum in. There's also a canned gas called private preserve that a lot of people use. And what they do is they just squirt that into the bottle after they open the bottle and serve wine by the glass. And it is a very heavy gas, so it places a protective coating, something like a blanket, on top of the wine, and it keeps the air completely out. If in doubt, what you can always do is ask your server to bring you just a taste of the wine. And I don't know many places that won't do that. That is, if they have a wine by the glass program. If it's only by the bottle, forget about it, and you don't have to worry about it anyway. But have them bring you a taste. That will tell you very quickly whether or not the wine is pristine and suitable for your drinking pleasure. Now, you can also ask them if the wine that you ordered has already been opened. If it has, then you might inquire as to how long it's been open. They probably won't know. If they tell you that they have to open a fresh bottle, then again, you're in pretty good shape. So those are just some things that I think you ought to keep in mind when you go into a restaurant or a wine bar. It's not bad etiquette for you to ask the right questions, but you know, just checking the place out a little bit, you'll learn very quickly. But I will tell you this, if the wine is turned and you're absolutely certain that it's turned, then send it back. If you like the wine after the server has recommended the wine to you, then send it back. But if you don't like the wine just because you ordered it and you didn't know enough about that particular bottle of wine, then you know what? Tap somebody on the shoulder next to you and ask them if they'd like to have your glass of wine. That's all I have to say on that subject. And speaking of etiquette, next up we have Wilfred Wong, the chief storyteller for wine.com. And we're going to talk about something that used to make my skin crawl, but it really doesn't anymore. We're going to talk about, oh gosh, can I even say it? Putting ice cubes in wine. It gives me the chills, and it will you next on Grape Encounters.
Connecting winemakers, wine lovers, wine adventures, and all things wine from around the globe. You are listening to Grape Encounters Radio with David Wilson, broadcasting from our wine cellar studio in idyllic Atascadero, centrally located in the Central Coast wine country of San Luis Obispo County, California.
And back with Grape Encounters Radio, our new regular guest, Wilfred Wong, once the cellar master at beloved BevMo out in the western U.S., but now conquering the world at wine.com, my favorite place to buy wine, for sure. Because if you want some help, they'll get somebody right online to help you out. They're experts over there. The people at wine.com really know their stuff. They are wine experts. But if you don't want to be bugged, if you just want to cruise through the aisle of wine.com online, you can do that too. And they won't bother you. But they got lots of great wine. Best selection of wine in the known world, I believe. Anyway, Wilfred, welcome back.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
What's on your mind today, Wilfred? Last week we talked about Merlots. I got all kinds of hate mail from the Marilyn Monroe fan club because you were not aware of the Marilyn Monroe 50-foot statue in downtown Palm Springs.
Sorry.
All right. Let's on your mind today, the mind of Wilfred Wong.
How about ice cubes in wine?
Oh, God. A wine drinker of your stature would even use the words ice cube and wine in the same sentence.
Well, I'm saying this because among most of us wine drinkers, we need to serve wine at the precise temperature and the right glass. A lot of wines that are served by all kinds of people are not of that ilk. They're just good, basic wines. And what if your Chardonnay is just too warm because you freaking forgot to put it in your refrigerator and then you're at a party? Well, then I'd say just go to the freezer, grab ice cubes, put them in there, make sure they don't melt too much. A little bit's okay, I guess.
Well, that's going to do it for Grape Encounters today. So glad that you could be with us. Thanks to my guest, Wilfred Wong. No. Are you serious?
Well, you know what? It's all about enjoyment.
Go,
pleasure and enjoyment.
Oh.
If the Chardonnay is too warm because you were not smart enough to chill it down, or you were too busy.
Why not take it and just shove it in the freezer for about 10 minutes?
But that works too.
How about getting one of those automatic chiller things?
It's even better. If you have it, but
how about caring enough about your wine drinking habit that you keep your wine at the right temperature to begin with?
That would be good.
Be a responsible wine drinker.
That would be good, but it doesn't always happen.
Okay, so I've got an alternative for you, Wilfred.
Yes.
Are you ready for this? Okay. Whiskey stones.
I've seen those and I've used those and they are good.
You know what they are, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. In fact, they are a very good accoutrement to wine.
Now, you can get those plastic ice cubes, you know, that have the coolant stuff inside, but that doesn't look good in your wine glass. But whiskey stones, I think, got a little class. In fact,
whiskey stones are good, but they're expensive.
Wilfred, do you not drink expensive wine?
I do.
Okay, then why are you concerned about how expensive a whiskey stone is? It's reusable, Wilfred.
Listen,
wouldn't it be nice if wine was reusable? Actually, some wine does taste like it was reused. All right, go ahead.
When I have an incredible wine to have, I'm going to orchestrate it so well that we don't need to resort to secondary measures.
Oh, so what you're saying is that when you invite me over to your house, if you're going to serve me a wine that needs to be chilled, it will be chilled to the right temperature.
Of course.
You were actually saying to the folks out there that it would be okay to put an ice cube in the wine.
You can do it. I mean, you have to watch it because if the ice cube melts in your glass, yes, it's going to water down your wine a little bit. So I wouldn't leave it in too long. And it's only a measure that, hey, you know what? It's hot out there. Need to do something good that works. So I have no problem putting an ice cube in a wine and then taking it out as soon as it gets down to a temperature that works for me. Sipping it along
the way. Am I being pretentious?
Yes, you are. Now that we're growing up in the wine culture in the USA, there's more and more of these items that are available. And if you have them, I would use them, of course. But having said that, if push comes to shove and you're in a fix and you need to get the wine to the right temperature, that's more important than saying that drinking your Chardonnay at 85 degrees.
Well, I just don't like the idea of the ice cube diluting the wine. I reported this a few times on Grape Encounters Radio, that if you are drinking a wine that's a little bit hot, meaning that it's got a bit too much alcohol, that actually, if you put that ice cube in there, it will actually infuse some water into the wine, chill it down, reduce the alcohol, and release some of the flavors in the wine and aerate the wine at the same time.
That is true, but that's a different purpose than the one
I'm just looking at killing two birds with one whiskey stone.
Well, we're talking about, actually, what I'm talking about is normal wine people buy at $5 or $6, whatever the cost is, and they just have it, and they rush to a party and need to get a cold, and sometimes you got to do that. I mean, if you do it carefully, you will enhance your experience, and you will not hurt the wine.
How about a chill bag?
Most people don't have a chill bag in their back pocket, but most people can find ice. It's not the perfect solution, but it's a good solution if you have no other.
That's it. Okay. But your solution is to just put ice in the glass.
Well, you want to get the temperature of the wine down to a temperature where it's going to taste better.
Okay. All right. We're going to have to agree to disagree.
That's okay.
On this one.
We can.
Is that all right?
No problem.
Okay. But let me ask you this, though. I want to finish with a question. You take guests to dinner. You study the wine list, finally choose a very, very good bottle of wine at that restaurant. $150 bottle of wine, okay?
Okay.
That's not even high-end for you.
It can be. It's
that's a budget wine
that's
for Wilfred
expensive.
Wong. Anyway, you get a $150 bottle of wine.
All right.
And then all of a sudden, one of your guests says to the waiter after the wine is poured, excuse me, could you get me just a glass with some ice in it, please? And you don't realize why she's doing this. And then the waiter shows up with the glass with the ice cubes. And then in horror, you look as she scoops the ice out of the glass and drops it into the wine glass, which presumably that glass of wine is worth about $35 all by itself. Are you horrified, or should people be left to their own devices?
Well, that's not a good thing. If she did that...
Will you grab her wrist?
I might.
Okay. All right. There's hope for you.
All right. I'm just talking about context of normal, what I call the camel soup category of wine. It's the value wine that you just buy for a party, and people drink it without seeing what it is and don't really care, as long as it tastes decently good.
Two different opinions there. I will tell you this, Wilfred, if you come to my house and in the unlikely event that I didn't get the wine chilled down to the right temperature, there will be a glass of whiskey stones waiting for you.
When you invite me to dinner, you will not make mistakes of that nature. I'm sure.
Thanks to wine.com for loaning us the inimitable Wilfred Wong. You say what you think, don't you, Wilfred?
Of course.
All right. We'll see you next week, Wilfred.
Pleasure.
Okay, that's going to do it for this edition of A Quick Bite with David Wilson. My deepest thanks to the number two, but almost number one wine blogger, Jim Newcomb, the Sommelier Update. Check it out. Also, big thanks to the Iceman, Wilfred Wong of wine.com. Well, just the Iceman in this edition. The wealth of information that is Sarah Schneider, the most well-mannered woman in any wine bar. We will see you next week, same time, same channel. Thanks for joining us on Grape Encounters Radio.
You never know what part of the country or the world the Grape Encounters microphones will take you to. Don't miss a single experience. Your Grape Encounter isn't over. We're just taking a breather until next week's edition.